Now we restore chaos, and Katie can celebrate the greatest article probably ever on McLuhan by Don Thiel, The Cultic World. Wasn't that pretty good, Katie?
Oh, I really liked it. I thought we'd talk about that tonight. Is that okay with you?
Yes. Yeah, it's about Crowleyite. It's about Crowley is mentioned in the article, Corbin. This article by Don Thiel, 1988, on McLuhan and the cults and the secret society. So take it away, Katie. You can lead.
Okay. So I loved this. I had posted a comment on your Facebook under the article saying that this is really what I was looking for when I read The Medium in the Light.
Yeah, now that really intrigued me. Wait, Katie, that's what I wondered. Were you thinking that The Medium in the Light, the word the light, referred to occult stuff? Is that what you thought would be in there? Like, I don't know why.
Or that he would have a more occult, or not occult, but mystic approach to his Catholicism.
Well, it turns out that he did.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to eventually find out that McLuhan invented a new kind of mysticism, which Don Thiel spends his books trying to figure out. I call it quadriphenic. I mean, remember my article, one day you're going to read my article, McLuhan and Holopathic Quadriphenia, which is the creme de la creme explanation of McLuhan. But you need to go through these phases, and yes, you want Marshall. Is he aware of the mystical tradition? He certainly is, and Don does a good article there on that point. So you're right to look for The Medium and the Light, the occult meanings. Very good there. Very good.
But I never got it out of The Medium and the Light. That's when we were having the discussion.
No.
I kept asking, what did he think of Christ? Because I thought that what I was looking for was what was his opinion of how man relates to his own deity. How does man resolve the problem that he is God? Not that it's a problem. But so what was McLuhan, I kept looking for what was Marshall doing that's analogous to what we're doing with Ion.
Right now, have you haven't finished the virtual McLuhan, have you? Virtual Marshall McLuhan.
No, I have not.
Because there's a whole chapter on that. What this article is, you know, made into a whole chapter in later in the Virtual Marshall McLuhan, and some of that will be gone into. But basically, Don thinks that McLuhan is a follower of Jansenism, which comes out of Pascal. He'd be the famous French writer, 1700s or whatever, who is popular and known as a Jansenist. And they believe that there was, like McLuhan's metaphor for acoustic space, centers everywhere, boundaries nowhere, and no margins, no center margin structures. That's what Don thinks is Marshall's value system in the world of mysticism, Jansenism.
Where does the term Jansenism come from? Who is it related to?
It's a Catholic faction, the Jansenist priest. You could just wiki it, Jansenism, Jansenism, and Blaise Pascal was the token writer of that word, that attitude. Basically, it's a quietistic, it's called quietistic meditative kind of thing in the Catholic tradition, Jansenism. And their definition of acoustic space is what McLuhan adopted. But remember, Marshall was on about tactility, which is not acoustic space. So Don Thiel may be categorizing Marshall as schizoid because Don doesn't fully get the quadriphenic nature of Marshall's mysticism. If Don is completely right, then I'm wrong. But I'm right, then Don's article are brilliant, but don't go all the way. And Don and I discussed and argued this for many years in the 2000s, you know, 1998 up to 2008 when he passed on. So I don't know if I have a recording of that. It might. It would be interesting to hear.
Yeah, it would.
See, you know, when someone dedicates a book, when someone starts a book with your name, he's not praising you. It's like McLuhan says, you can be damn sure that when I speak about something, I'm against it. Because most people, matching with their external reality, they try to speak about what they're for. Right? Try to impose it on the reality outside them. That's visual bias. When Marshall talked about whatever he talked about, it wasn't necessarily for it. So when Don begins Virtual Marshall McLuhan saying, this book is a result of encountering Robert Dobbs, and certain serendipitous events, it doesn't mean it's dedicated to me or that he likes me or he wants to fuck Carolyn or something. No. He is engaged. Just keep it in the high and low.
You had to get that in there, didn't you?
Yeah, I have to get in there. You know, Susan, I'm obsessed with sex, so I got to throw it every 5 minutes. But he's setting up a dialectic with me. He is arguing with me. It's unspoken, you know what I mean? Unless you know the code.
Yep.
He's saying, this book is a result of Dobbs fucked me up. Now I've got to write another book about McLuhan to talk my way out of the rabbit hole that Dobbs put me in. All right? So that's what that means. That dedication.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
It does. Okay, so in the very
more
in the very beginning when the very beginning of the article, he mentions the book that the author from Quebec wrote.
Yeah, Jacques Langueyrand. Unfortunately,
thank
they're not
you.
Translated, but they're very good books. It's worth buying them, getting them, you know, used anyways because of the pictures in them.
Okay, so you have not read the McLuhan Apathagor?
I have a copy of that book from McLuhan to Pythagoras, or Pythagoras to McLuhan, whatever the title is, but it's in French, and I'm not too good at reading French anymore. So
okay.
I just look at the pictures. And Don gave me the outline of the idea, so I would go by Don's verbal translation of it when we talked about him.
Okay.
Here's one thing. Don went on to be president of the university and is a well-known Joyce scholar, but here's what's interesting. When you read his books, and he's citing authorities or filmmakers or this and that, they're always his friends. He only cites his friends when he writes his scholarly books, which is pretty neat. You don't hear much of that from scholar world. You know, Jacques Langueyrand was
really
a long...
competitive.
Right. And he's citing Jacques Langueyrand. He's citing Mayakovsky, whoever that guy was, who Dusan Mayakovsky, the awkward name, did a great bunch of movies. One of them was called Sweet Movie. Another was on Wilhelm Reich, Mysteries of the Organism or Orgasm or something. And then and everybody else is he mentions generally in there, if they were alive, he would include them. That's why he included me in there. I was his friend, you know.
That's cool.
Yeah.
That's very cool. So we're getting into a more esoteric definition than of the artist. This got me really, really excited. I feel like a lot of what we're doing with the bionic material is similar. This is the old occult stuff. Isn't necessary anymore.
Oh yeah,
Ion
definitely completes it. That Ion completes all this, and that's why I feature it. It's an important prelude to the best of before Ion showed up. And
it is.
You could read, if you have the book there. We never did it yet. Read page 51. Is it Virtue McLuhan? That great quote from McLuhan.
Read that.
Don't say
to pull that out.
Yeah. This is a really important quote, people. This is three figures Ion, literally.
Okay, on page 51 in chapter 2?
Yes.
Is that what you're talking about?
When yeah, 5-1. Is it 5-1 or 6-1?
It doesn't seem like it's 5-1 to me. 5-1 is the first page of chapter 2, McLuhan, the course.
Okay, so it must
writing.
Be 6-1. It's a McLuhan quote. It's a quote from McLuhan. The drama, I'm not going to say the rest of it until you read the quote.
Okay.
Page 61, then, if it's not...
Oh, here
61.
It is. McLuhan again and again stresses that he is reading the collective unconscious of the drama of society, even though he uses other signs to symbolize this. Gregory Bateson's writing, which McLuhan certainly read, should prepare us to understand this position, since Bateson has argued that the most important aspects of what we ought to consider the unconscious are only revealed by turning Freud upside down. When McLuhan repeatedly refers to Joyce's, his producers, are they not his consumers? He is asserting that only through reading the social text produced by the participants in society can the poet or any artist produce his own text. Oh, I love that so much. For its producers, that social text is primarily unconscious. The artist transforms it by making sense of the producer's work, which they then consume, literally devouring it. About this, McLuhan says in a letter to the Canadian poet Wilfred Watson, his collaborator in writing from cliché to archetype, redoing old things, remember the phrase in the Mass, and this must be in Latin, mirabiliter conditusi, I can't read this, it's in Latin, mirabilibus reformaste, miraculously founded, still more miraculously reformed. Is that what you were talking about?
No, no, it's the drama of the, and I'm not going to say the final word. Just look up page 61.
It's the drama of the mouth.
Right.
The drama of the mouth. We participate daily in the total recreation of the world as a process.
Yeah, what page is that?
That is 61 in the middle of the page. It's underneath everything that I read prior.
It right, 61. 61, 61, not 5-1. Okay, read that part again. Listen to this, people. Listen to what Mark Marshall says.
It is the difference between matching and making, between spectatorship and total dramatic participation. Through the drama of the mouth, you participate daily in the total recreation of the world as a process.
But you think that, Carol? Through the drama of the mouth, you recreate the world. Now, isn't that the words make your reality? Isn't that what Ion says?
Yeah, that's it right there.
Yeah, and nobody says it like McLuhan does. I don't. No one's ever said it that way that I know of.
Drama.
And I've read everything.
Mm-hmm. Well, did you know that quote before you saw it in Thiel's book?
Yes, it's in Marshall's letters.
Okay.
Isn't it? What does it give the note there where that is in the letters, Katie?
No.
It should have a
It's a letter to the. It's a letter to the Canadian poet Wilfred Watson. So he's writing to Wilfred Watson.
And you look down the bottom of the page or go to that chapter's notes to get the citation. Doesn't have a number after it?
This doesn't have a number after it, nope.
It didn't get cited. Well, it's in the letters. You would look up Wilfred Watson and look for all the letters to Wilfred Watson by McLuhan. You'll find that one. If I get a chance later, I'll look it up myself. But that's really important, the drama of the mouth. See, when you say the phrase, the drama of cognition, which Marshall uses a lot, you'll think of the brain or your perceptual faculties behind your eyes, you know, where you cognize. No, the drama of cognition is in your mouth.
Mm-hmm.
And what's great is that Katie noticed that quote. Katie pointed that quote out to me, a month ago, and she noticed it. No one ever else has ever mentioned it to me. And of course, no one else ever read The Virtual Marshall McLuhan, so you don't have much competition, Katie.
Oh, well.
You're mapping new territory. No one's been into this territory with me. Nobody's written any maps. You're mapping new stuff. That's why Ed Long features you on Ion and Bob, blogspot.com.
Yeah. This is the most natural thing in the world for me now.
Yes, and you...
You're laughing at me.
Yes, I am mocking you at certain levels. So don't worry about it. It's necessary.
You can totally mock me.
That was the name of the beach we were at, Gene. Makapu Beach. Ulawa Makapu. That's where that picture was taken at.
You want to know what's so funny? Is my nickname that my family calls me is Pooh. So you're mocking
Pooh. Oh, really?
Makapu.
Makapu.
Yeah.
Well, there it is. The drama of the external outer kingdom language. Miming what was coming an hour or two later, because that was posted on Chatline, an hour or two ago.
Mm-hmm.
But, okay, back to this point of your... see where he talks about... McLuhan says the... What was the dialectic there between the something and the something before you come to the drama of the mouth? Matching and making was one of them, but...
Yeah, matching and making, which is what the artist does. The artist takes in what McLuhan did. He stole from everybody else and didn't even necessarily always give them credit or cite them. They also his work and go ahead.
Yeah. Listen to this. So you've got the dialectic East and West, the Gnostic and the Catholic, the matching and the making, and isn't there something else in that quote you gave me? He said earlier, before matching making, was there another part that you read where he gives two other items, visual space, acoustic space or something? Just look back.
No. I mean, there's a little bit more. It's a difference between matching and making between spectatorship and teledramatic
that
participation.
Was there it is, spectatorship and dramatic participation. So this dialectic is presented in Don's article from 1988 on McLuhan, the cultic inventor, and the cultic inventors. See, that dialectic, McLuhan came to a resolution of that. Now, deep mysticism always comes to a reconciliation of yes and no. But when it's externalized, the reconciliation is made an external environment, then that is new, that the outer kingdom, the electric media, resolve the battle between the eye and the ear, and it's done through tactility and the extension of tactility. Now, if you notice, I posted this week this man named John Fekete, F-E-K-E-T-E, who does the inaugural introduction for 11 minutes for Dr. Mark Hansen. And if you listen to Mark Hansen, he goes into this mathematical nonsense. It's ridiculous. How could anybody sit there and know what he's talking about, right? It's too ridiculous. These people are sitting there in the Peterborough Trent University, supposedly taking this in. Anyways, back to John Fekete. His book, The Critical Twilight, came out about 1977. He was a very good colleague of Don Thiel. As a matter of fact, he was a student of Don Thiel's in the late 60s at McGill, and he ran the student newspaper. So under the influence of Walter Bowert and Abby Hoffman and Paul Krasner and the Realists and all those radical new underground newspapers, he turned John Fekete, that bald guy you see speaking there in 2013, last November, he turns the student newspaper into a radical radical student muckraking anarchist sheet, right? And the administration did not approve of this in Canada. Yeah, you can do it in New York City, but not in Montreal. So he was charged with a bunch of stuff. And years ago when I was at Don's home, he showed me the archives, the newspaper articles, where John Fekete got in big trouble at the university, but Don Thiel stepped forward to defend him. So Don Thiel was the radical professor, the one who aligned with the screwed-up students and the confused students, the affluent kids who were having a massive identity crisis in the global theater, and they called it Marxism or Maoism. But Don Thiel stepped forward and became quite controversial as a professor supporting the radical students. So what happened later is that John Fekete goes to Trent University as a professor, and he's teaching there like from about 1976. He's the one who wrote to Don. I don't know what he said, but I imagine he said, "Don, we've got a whole university here. We can run amok. We can tear the hide off of Canada that McLuhan claimed he was going to do but failed to do. We can do it here from Peterborough." So he told Don to apply to, you know, Don is quite old, you know, 15 years older than John Fekete, let's say, or more. He told Don to apply to Trent for the new job, president of the university, which had just come up, and John Fekete as a professor at Trent, he knew this. So he told Don, "Hey, apply." And Don got the gig. And Don, he ruled the roost there at Peterborough Trent University till 1987, when he and John Fekete and their Coker Quadrant gang put on a radical underground film festival. And, of course, there was a heavy neo-conservative right-wing gang surfacing in Ontario at that point. So they attacked Don in Peterborough. They upset the whole. They went after Don, you know, riding in on the neo-conservative Canadian wave that was happening. And they forced Don out as president of the university. So John Fekete was part of the battle. But John Fekete went on representing the faculty of professors. He's awarded, if you notice the bio I give of him, he goes on to be the head of the union parts, and he gets all these awards. They've even named a lecture after him, the inaugural John Fekete lecture. So he managed to squeak by while Don took the hit. And so it would be fun to get a hold of John Fekete and interview him about all this stuff, you know. Now, his book, though, The Critical Twilight, very complex book. It's Marxist analysis, Frankfurt School analysis, showing how McLuhan was an evil counter-revolutionary. So the argument between Thiel and McLuhan carries on through John Facchetti. And what's interesting, I've been promoting Dr. Mark Hansen, the past year or so, recommending people read his books. Here's John Facchetti out of the blue invites Hansen up to Peterborough to do the first inaugural lecture. So there's a nice synchronicity there. Let's see, what would be the other thing to say? But John Facchetti right now, since he's retired, he is on vacation or on sabbatic. No, he's not on that. He's just not around in Canada during the winter because he doesn't have to teach. He's retired. So we have to wait till he comes back before you'll get a chance, Katie, to interrogate him.
So what did Thiel do after?
Oh, this is a good question by Karen. So what did Thiel do?
What did Thiel do after he lost the presidency?
He actually came into his power. What he did is he had time to read again, having been a busy executive, you know, for 10 years. Mm-hmm. And he read Stuart Brand's book, The MIT Lab. He always mentions the book in his articles. Stuart Brand, the old hippie guy who started the Whole Earth Catalog and made that first picture of the planet that the astronauts saw on the moonshot in 69. He popularized that through the Whole Earth Catalog. Well, he started getting interested in high-tech stuff in the 80s, so he interviewed all the scientists at MIT's Media Lab, and he wrote a book called The MIT Lab or MIT Media Lab or something in the late 80s. And in it, he talked about how the researchers there used the art and the insights of the surrealists and the avant-garde movements of the modernist period, say the early 20th century, and he also cited they used McLuhan. So Don saw, now I can bring back McLuhan, and he's doing this before the McLuhan revival through Wired magazine, which starts in 1993. So Don is looking at this stuff. And he says, now I can bring back the corrected McLuhan and emphasize Finnegan's Wake by saying that James Joyce's Finnegan's Wake anticipated digital culture. So he wrote this famous article in 1992 showing how the digital researchers, the scientists, used insights of McLuhan and James Joyce, and I don't know if they used Finnegan's Wake in particular, but the way the avant-garde writers discussed and broke down the different sensory apparatus and the central nervous system. Mm-hmm. The scientists need to know this to digitize the process of cognition on their way to make artificial intelligence and whatever else they were trying to make. So Don got this posted in the Postmodern Journal in 1992, and everybody was amazed at how Don related Finnegan's Wake to the present Internet. And the Internet's not going to surface till 95 for most people, mm-hmm. but this is 92. And so he was able to move. He got a lot of attention over the next 10 years of that, him being on the leading edge. Because just as McLuhan in the 50s said that the beatniks, the beehives, the surfers, the Kennedys, all that 50s, early 60s culture was a product of television and its mosaic image, its tactile mesh, Don replayed the McLuhan method by pointing out digiculture was coming from Finnegan's Wake and James Joyce. Just as McLuhan said, tactile TV was mentioned on page 52 in Finnegan's Wake. So the English profs, that McLuhan and Thiel were trying to revitalize literature, just like McLuhan did with Mechanical Bride, get the kids interested in literature by showing them their culture ads and comics and movies and magazines. The method was to do that each time by the Toronto School of Communication, which is a phrase that Don Thiel came up with. So he successfully got a name for himself, and he started to be around and lecture and talk and be well-known like McLuhan was in the 50s, 60s because of that article. But he only got to do that because he got removed from the presidency. And he told me years later that he did waste his time a bit. He said, I shouldn't have gone for power that I went and got involved with in the 70s and 80s. I should have done what I was later did in the 90s, should have done that earlier, and he would have been more satisfied. So he caught up with himself, but he got way late.
And he was able to make a living doing that?
Oh, yes, he would get big grants. He'd get the biggest grants from the Canadian Humanities Research Council. He got the grant to do $80,000 or something to do the trilogy, which was, turned out, 1995, Beyond the Word, 1997, James Joyce's Technopoetics, part three is The Virtual Marshall McLuhan. Three books published by the University of Toronto Press, and he got a big, big grant. And so, as a matter of fact, I think, as a result of the power struggle at Trent, Don told me that the new administration, arranged so that he didn't get a proper pension.
Mm.
You know what I mean? They tried to really screw him.
Right, right, right.
And so he implied or told me that his faction, his buddies in the Canadian government at the national grant place giving out research grants, they made sure that Don got a big grant.
Uh-huh.
In other words, they made up for the neocons that sabotaged his pension.
Wow.
So he was able to have a lot of money to travel, and that's why he came to New York a couple times. He was able to come to all those conferences I got him into, and that's why the book is dedicated to me. Bob kept on going in the final years.
You did, Bob. You did.
I did it again.
I'm there
I've
to
saved
witness.
So many people. And it all was part of the agenda, though. It all worked. I think his phrase, ecology of sense, is what we're going to use now on rather than paramedicology or mediacology. And he's the one who coined the term paramodern rather than postmodern. So Don was a very important critic that does not get the recognition in the general mainstream that he should. So I'm doing that. And so I would like to get John Facchetti to discuss his life with Don, if I can get him on the phone.
Yeah, you will.
So, I mean, this article that we were talking about, the McLuhan and the Cultic Adventures, Katie, is the key to McLuhan. Now, while you're talking, I'm going to look up something and read you where McLuhan gives the hint to prove what Don is saying. I have to look up my own article. You can talk for a minute. Carolyn, you ask Katie some questions or say something to her.
Hey, Katie, what page are you on, Virtual McLuhan?
I've read the first 50 pages of Virtual McLuhan. All the preludes and introductions, it's just through the first 50.
Ooh. Right,
and then I read this article for this week.
Oh, okay. Yeah, because every once in a while, you know, as a presumed bedtime story, Bob will try to read me a few paragraphs from Virtual McLuhan, and it's just so tangled up, and it's just so abstract and abstruse. I just run away screaming. It drives me to bed. It puts me to sleep.
She doesn't have a natural abstract mind. She has the tinkering tomboy gadget lover mind. You know, she can fix anything, but you start talking big thoughts, Carol gets lost.
So, yeah.
Oh, that's not
Katie,
true.
I know it's not true, but it's funny.
It's funny. So, Katie, funny. When you read it, I mean, when you read an abstract sentence, are you kind of matching it with stuff you already know, or does it bring you into new stuff? I mean, how do you approach that type of phraseology?
I don't know. I just read it a line at a time.
Mm-hmm.
I just keep reading it. And, you know, I'm so invested in this search because I see myself as an artist. And when I first started looking at this stuff months ago, I was thinking of an artist as someone who works with a muse to bring something beautiful through them. That was the highest definition of artist that I could come up with. And then I remembered reading recently McLuhan saying an artist is somebody who knows what's going on in the culture and can write about it and foreshadow what's going on in the culture for people. And then was really ballsy and said would even have a say in what was going on in the culture, be able to influence culture through art. And now I'm starting to think that that's not so ballsy. Like, I feel like I could do that, which Bob will mock
do me what?
For.
Influence the culture through art? Is that what
I want to be that kind of an artist. That kind of an artist.
Right. Now, Carolyn influences people through her medicine. Now, what's interesting is that I don't know if she's not, but I'm assuming Katie's not a gadget lover. She might be forced to because she lives out there in the Virginia mountains, but she naturally thinks the way you don't think, Carol. She thinks abstractly,
theoretically. No, Katie's a tomboy. Right, Katie?
Can you fix things, Katie?
Yeah. I can fix things. I've always loved instructions.
Well, then you're better than Carolyn. Come on over.
No, because what Carolyn has, Carolyn can, like, look at guts and sew things up and do blood. And, I mean, I would.
Oh, you can't do that?
Like that.
No, don't bother coming here. You need to know. You want to be part of my little team here. You
yeah, it's like
that.
My older sister said to me, well, I should have been a doctor, but I couldn't stand the sight of blood. And it's like, duh.
Yeah, blame it on the blood.
Yeah, right.
I can't
anyway.
Do anything like that. But
okay,
the
but
thing
you,
that
you,
I...
Go
ahead. Go ahead, Burger Time.
So you have a bit of you can do on hands, fix your car when
hands
tire,
on Bob,
when the
not
tire,
on hands.
Yeah.
He doesn't need
on hands
know what hands on means. Damn.
Yeah, so you you can fix the flat tire and stuff like that?
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah, and love technology.
Well, very good. So it's interesting. You're going for healing the mind of the culture. Carolyn heals the
mm-hmm.
body of the culture.
Mm-hmm. And I'm going to read this paragraph. This is just on the second page of the McLuhan and the Cult article. McLuhan's entire approach depended on the conviction that an artist is an individual who has special insight into the future directions of his culture. If the poet's own knowledge is in part esoteric, and this would be quite a legitimate interpretation of the role of the poet or artist in many cultures, then the function he performs is in understanding the future of his culture is in itself enmeshed in the occult and hermetic. And I look at that now, and I think about what we're doing, and the Ionic material completes all that.
Yeah.
So we're all poets, but instead of using the occult and the hermetic, we're using the Ionic.
Which is scientific, occult, architectural, anthropological, neurological, street-bound,
mm-hmm.
homeless, pissed off,
right.
The whole range. Now, let me get, here's where McLuhan gives his clue. Back in 1954, the unpublished article, it may now be published in one of those McLuhan collections, but back then it wasn't. It was called Eliot and the Manichaean Myth as Poetry. And he addressed the Catholic Renaissance Society. That's the journal Renaissance, where he wrote a lot of reviews in it in the late 40s, early 50s. So he says, this is Marshall talking about himself. And he's doing this in the early 50s when nobody really knows what he's going to do yet. But he says, a Catholic poet like Paul Claudel, C-L-A-U-D-E-L, who was a known poet back then in the 40s and 50s, a Catholic poet like Paul Claudel, of course, is not bound to these Manichaean dichotomies of space and time, the vertical and the horizontal. You hear Don talk about the vertical school and the horizontal school, those
mm-hmm.
two secret society factions. And
east
he got that from Marshall.
East is vertical and west is, east is horizontal and west,
and the west
is vertical.
Is vertical. Right. Okay, so space and time, you put that dichotomy in there. So he says, These dichotomies that the secret Gnostic societies use is not something the Catholic poet gets involved in. So here's how McLuhan writes it. Claudel is not bound by these dichotomies of space and time or the vertical and the horizontal, but all he has written is strongly marked with this keen awareness of the space-time controversies or secret dogmas in art, politics, and religion. In brackets, to the European, the comparative American ignorance of these doctrines as elaborated in art is precisely what constitutes American innocence. End of bracket. Thus, in his section of essay called On Time in something called Poetic Knowledge, or maybe just the whole title, the way I've done it, I can't tell. On Time in Poetic Knowledge, that article, Claudel takes up, just a minute, who's making noise in the background? Let me just check that. Not Corbin. Oh, it's this person here. See, I can see the where it leaks through. Okay, so in this essay on time and poetic knowledge, Claudel takes up the space position, that would be the horizontal school, then appropriates the time ammunition as well. So he uses both, space
mm-hmm.
and time, vertical school and the horizontal school. And then McLuhan says, Claudel's thought and poetry obviously move freely in both time and space. As a symbolist, Claudel avails himself to the utmost degree of the spatial techniques of inner and outer landscape for fixing particular states of mind, or effects, I would add, for creating effects. Mm-hmm. This procedure makes available to Claudel all the magical resources invoked by the Romantic poets for using particular emotions as immediate windows onto being, capital B, being, as techniques of co-natural union with reality. So that's a kind of a merger, which the Romantics were into, because they were subject to the split caused by the printing press. So they're trying to recover pre-literate acoustic merger, right?
But, is that the re-enchantment of the world?
That's part of it. That's where Don, okay. Don could make the distinctions I'm making, but he doesn't bother in that essay. It's more of an introductory essay. But if you know what I know, then you would bring that point up. But wait a minute, this re-enchantment, that's the first school of Romantic symbolists. What about the second school of Romantic symbolists, or just symbolists, which is Baudelaire and the guys in the late 19th century that I recently talked to Dennis Young about, which you will hear when that's released. And it's very key, the symbolism Mallarmé in McLuhan's world and Joyce and Eliot's world. So that's called the second romantic movement. They're different from the guys trying to get co-natural union with reality. They're dealing with the electric age, the second phase. So Claudel values equally the resources of dialectic and continuous discourse. He can therefore be both Senecan, that's Seneca, Roman writer. He can be Senecan or symbolist, and or temporal. That would seem to be an inevitable program for any Catholic for whom time and space or the secret society doctrines are not sectarian problems. The Catholic figures has got some solution to. He's not going to get involved in these Gnostic mystical things, at least the secular or normal Catholic, the mainstream Catholic, not the Thomas Merton mystic type. That Catholic would be a Thomist, because St. Thomas Aquinas successfully beat back the Gnostic mystics and Manichaeans and all that back in the 1200s, 1300s, whenever he wrote. And then the Catholic Church stands on that. And that's also implied in the Holy Blood, Holy Grail, and the Da Vinci Code. That's the battle between the mystics and the bureaucrats of Rome. So McLuhan's saying the true Catholic poet does not get involved in these controversies, but can use them as content. They are not problems for the Catholic. Then McLuhan says, today, many thoughtful people are torn between the claims of time and space. And so many Catholics, or American Catholics, are innocent, don't know this Manichaean battle. And these people speak of the crucifixion of intellectual man as he is mentally torn in these opposite directions. This is McLuhan talking. As the dispute quickens, the Catholic is more and more reminded of the inexhaustible wisdom and mercy of the cross at every intersection instant of space and time. See, that's the meaning of the cross for the profound Catholic. It's the interval between space and time. You get that?
Mm-hmm.
It's a resonant interval. Mm-hmm. That's the name of our dupes form, resonantnode.com. So, as the Catholic becomes more and more reminded of the inexhaustible wisdom and mercy of the cross at every intersection instant of space and time, these moments of intersection became for Father Anthony Hopkins and also for James Joyce epiphanies, and for Claudel, too. It is not the purpose of this paper, says McLuhan, to explain the complex falsehoods of the time and space schools of aesthetics, religion, and politics. For a Catholic, it is easy to admire and use much from these schools from each position. But by and large, the vertical camp is rationalist, and the horizontal camp is magical in its theory of art and communication. So I end the quote there. So McLuhan is talking about how the Catholic poet plays with the secular paganism, the secret societies, the mystical traditions, mm-hmm. and Manichaeanism. Because the Catholic is not supposed to feel it's a fallen world. The mystic thinks it's a fallen world. Or at least the Manichaean mystic, the Gnostic mystic, the Hermetics. They try to escape. So this dialectic is what Don is talking about in his essay. And he is talking about how McLuhan uses hot and cool as symbols for the time and space schools. That has never been mentioned. Why is there 30, by anybody else, why is there 33 chapters in Understanding Media? As McLuhan's putting on the 32 and 33 degrees of the Freemasonic Gnostics and mystics. So his book, now what Don doesn't go far, does nobody goes this far. This book is not written by Marshall McLuhan. This book is the voice of a cartoonist or a cartoon.